So, Chris, what is this about us needing a social media manager?
Well, our Instagram account is too full of dog photos for it to be really useful for growing the podcast.
Right, okay, but could you at least handle our Twitter account?
Right, so even though I am now verified on Twitter and, you know, exist as a human being as far as Twitter is concerned, I have an incomplete understanding of how Twitter works. So, no, because social media is stupid to me.
Okay, so, all right, so I guess we should hire somebody. So we are looking right now for a social media manager and strategist, somebody to promote our show on social media in creative ways. It's 2 hours a week. It's paid. It would start in September. So if you are interested or if you know someone who is interested, you can send your CV and a brief description to thebodyofevidence@gmail.com. Deadline for applications is July 30th. Visit bodyofevidence.ca for more details.
So basically, to be clear, we're paying this person, but we're still doing this unpaid.
Yeah. It's a show about medicine.
Pending FDA approval.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're going to look at the evidence behind medical topics. And the show is
called... Wait. No, I want to say it. I want to say it.
I want to say it. I want to say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of...
Body of evidence.
It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
We are joined by Dr. Tanya Bubala. Dr. Bubala is the Dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. She is a fellow of the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences and of the Royal Society of Canada. She has a professional degree in law with distinction and a PhD in the biological sciences. Her impressive CV is 74 pages long, and I could spend the whole hour simply listing off the reasons why she is eminently qualified to be our guest today. But suffice to say that her research interests include the impact of innovation in science, the commercialization of these innovations, and matters of intellectual property. So, Dean Bubala, thank you so much for making the time to speak to us.
You're very welcome. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
All right. So the COVID-19 vaccines, their production and their distribution have led to many debates online and in the press. And the main argument that I've seen can be summarized in this way, that we're in the middle of a planetary public health crisis. We have safe and effective vaccines, but doses are being manufactured at a relatively small pace, given the urgency of the situation. And the manufactured doses are, by and large, going to wealthy countries, which is amplifying pre-existing inequalities between the global north and the global south, which used to be described more hierarchically as developed countries and developing countries. And so that argument goes, what is driving this problem of not enough shots in the arms of the people who need them are patents on the COVID-19 vaccines. If we get rid of these patents, the argument goes, anyone can start manufacturing these vaccines and we can avert a worse crisis. So before we explore this very specific argument, maybe you can tell us what a patent is, who is in charge of giving out patents, and sort of briefly the history of patents in vaccine development.
Right. Well, maybe I'll go back to tell you a little bit about the history of patents. The first patents were issued in Venice for glass blowing. And they have a really interesting history because they used to be used as a mechanism to bring new innovations into a country. So you are actually given letters patent, which are fundamentally a monopoly within the borders of a country to bring new arts and new manufacturing processes and new products to that country. So going out and stealing other people's intellectual property and bringing it into your own innovation system was actually rewarded by letters patent. So that's the old way that we used to think about patents as a form of intellectual property. Well, of course, that has changed, where innovative countries are now using patents not for the importation of new ideas, but to protect the ideas that are generated within their borders. And so what patents are is they're a form of protection. They're what we call negative rights. So patents don't give you the right to do anything. You can have a patent over something that you will never be able to use because there are other laws and regulations that prevent you from using or developing that technology, for example. So what patents give you is the right to exclude others. That's why we call it a negative right, right? So you get the right to exclude others from doing a range of things, which are basically making, manufacturing, selling, importing, exporting, all of those kinds of commercial things that you think of when you think of patents as part of a business strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And they last for 20 years.
20 years, okay. And who is in charge of giving out patents? I'm guessing it's the government.
Well, yeah. So this is the other really interesting thing about patents is that patents end at the border of the country, right? So most patent laws in countries are national. So we don't have provincial patents in Canada, for example, or state patents in the United States. The patents are national under our constitution. They're under the purview or under the legal authority of the federal government. And so you get a Canadian patent, but you can enforce a Canadian patent in the US and vice versa. Canadian patents are good in Canada. And so if you have an innovation, what you really need to think about is where are my markets? So where are all of those other entities that I want to exclude from my line of business or my patent-protected innovation? And those are the countries that you think about getting a patent in so you can control the innovation in those countries. And so there are mechanisms at the global level that allow you sort of this international treaties that let you get what the most important thing is your priority date. That's the date from which all of the patent criteria are judged. And you can get that date to apply around the world in all of the countries that are part of this international treaty called the Patent Cooperation Treaty. But you still have to get the patent in every single country that you want to have patent rights in.
I see. If we look at vaccines, were vaccines always patented? How did this association begin?
Well, most biomedical innovations will have some layer of patents around them, right? So there are a lot of industries that are very reliant on patents, and there are industries that are less reliant on patents. The biopharmaceutical industry in general is very reliant on patents. And that causes all kinds of problems, which we'll get into in our discussion. But the bottom line is you can patent anything that is new. That means it's absolutely new to the world. It's useful. So some countries it's useful, some countries it's industrial application. So that basically is, you know, can it be used for the purpose that you say that it's useful for? And then there is this weird thing that's called either in some countries it's called an inventive step, and in other countries it's called not obvious. So it's sort of an expansion of that concept of novelty. So you know, would anybody have thought of this?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the criteria, right? And right. So most things that you would put into making a vaccine or a pharmaceutical product, if they meet those patent criteria, they are patent eligible. So they're patentable.
Mm-hmm.
And then it depends on the business strategy within the industry as to the extent to which things are patented and those patents are relied on.
Does the source of funding have any impact on whether something is patentable or not. So if your biomedical research that ultimately leads to a vaccine is funded by public money, like the NIH or Health Canada or whatever, does that make it less likely that you can get a patent, or does that not matter in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. I've got to go back a little bit in history here to sort of around the 80s. There was a change in the laws in the United States that kind of changed the way that publicly funded institutions think about patents. As you know, publicly funded research that's done in academic institutions or hospitals or health research institutions or by government, they're often the driving engine of the really cutting edge innovative stuff that maybe takes 20 or 30 years to get into use in hospitals or in patients, right? Mm-hmm. And so the laws changed in the United States to allow those institutions to hold patent rights. And it was done as part of industrial policy to actually encourage institutions to hold patent rights. And it has created the sort of industry of university technology transfer offices or university industry liaison offices, sometimes they're called, that are fundamentally these centralized offices within universities and other research institutions whose sole job it is to go around and find patentable inventions or get patent disclosures from researchers within the institution, apply for patents, and then try to do deals to commercialize those inventions. And so patents are often thought of as the first step in that commercialization process. But we'll get into why this has become increasingly problematic. So we're just talking about what a patent is right now. A patent is a thing that gives an entity or a person exclusive rights or rights to exclude others for 20 years. It's a piece of control over a piece of technology that meets the patent criteria. The real issue is what you do with that patent, right? How you can exercise that power for good or evil.
So let's delve into the meat of the matter then. So thank you for this introduction to what a patent is and what its purpose is. So if we focus on COVID and on the COVID vaccines, some have argued that patents should be lifted, while others have pointed out that simply would not be enough because these vaccines are very complex to produce. They require very specific and rare infrastructure, building blocks also that are not readily available. So what are your thoughts generally about the idea of lifting, quote unquote, lifting COVID-19 vaccine patents and the impact that this could have in making more vaccine doses available?
Yeah, so issuing patent waivers or a range of other options of getting around thorny patent numbers of patents or patent thickets, I would say is an ex ante or a closing the barn door after the horse is bolted problem in innovation chains. So you've created the problem with a whole lot of patents, and now you're trying to fix it by forcing the hand of industrial actors that are used to using patents in specific ways. Mm-hmm. And so is it enough? Will lifting the two ways are there's compulsory licensing provisions. So this is basically government forcing a patent holder to license the use of a specific technology to someone that can make use of it. So in this case, a vaccine manufacturer. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's a compulsory licensing approach. There's the, Moderna approach, which is we're not going to enforce our patents for the length of the COVID-19 pandemic. But the problem is, especially in something as complex as really novel systems of vaccine production, a patent is a big, long document that if you read a patent and then you tried to practice that patent, you tried to put that patent into action, there's probably a 0% chance that you would be successful. Because what you really need is all of that locked up knowledge of the know-how, the which way do you stir the pot kind of things, that all those little quirks and tricks that come with know-how and people. There's a lot of sort of technological expertise to actually be able to practice the invention, in this case, the vaccine, so make the vaccine. So without also really sharing that technical information and those skills and the technical expertise to get the manufacturing plants up and running with a completely new set of technologies in some of the cases of some of the vaccines, the just lifting the patents is not nearly enough to be able to manufacture them. And the other thing you got to take into account here is that you're working in a really regulated space, right? Mm-hmm. So this again is just because you have a patent doesn't mean that you will ever be able to practice it, because you've got this whole regulatory layer that sits over the top, right? Yeah. And so you've got to set up manufacture in such a way that it's going to meet the very stringent health regulatory, safety and safety criteria for vaccine manufacturing plants. So it's not as simple as just lifting the patents.
Right. You mentioned Moderna that has committed to not enforcing its patents during the pandemic. But, again, given everything that you've said, and I've read the same as well, it seems that, since they are not sharing all of their intellectual property and data and know-how and the direction which you need to stir this vat in order to get the vaccine to be the right consistency, so to speak, is this a meaningful thing to pledge, in your opinion? Because it rings to my ears as a sort of beneficence theater. You're saying, well, we're not going to enforce it, but then it would be very difficult to enforce it because other people outside of Moderna, they don't have all the information they need to reproduce that particular vaccine.
Yeah, so it depends what else Moderna is doing as well, right? So mm-hmm. if Moderna is in fact sharing all of that other information, basically providing the skill up, not just the scale up, then, they actually are doing something meaningful. And in some ways, it's in their best interest, because the Moderna technology, the mRNA platform technology that they have a fairly substantial intellectual property portfolio or patent portfolio over, is very new. And it's in their interests to, once we emerge out of the pandemic, remember that that platform technology of mRNA will be able to be used for a large array or a lot of different kinds of vaccines, but not just for different vaccines, also for therapeutic development, right? Mm-hmm. So it's in their interests in some way to create the energy and the facilities that are actually going to be able to build out and eventually license their other products. And take those to market relatively rapidly.
So I was having this conversation with a friend of mine, and we were discussing why, for example, Pfizer hasn't licensed out their vaccine, their COVID vaccine, because, they have a finite limit to their production capacity, and allowing somebody else to make, a version of their mRNA vaccine wouldn't actually affect their profits to any substantive degree in the long term, I don't think. But the argument that we were discussing and what was ultimately said was, is, and I think this is what you alluded to, is it, it's not that Pfizer cares all that much about the COVID vaccine. They care about all the future projects that they are going to develop using mRNA technology. And so they don't want people to learn all their technical secrets because they want to develop other stuff in the future that might be potentially much more lucrative for them.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. You know, Pfizer is a company that is much more mature than a company like Moderna. And so their ability to scale out and scale up in terms of their manufacturing capacity around the world is much greater. And they do tend to be a company whose business strategy is very protectionist around IP. I wouldn't underestimate the profit potential for a company like Pfizer from COVID. I mean, COVID isn't going anywhere, right? This is probably going to turn into, you know, like your annual flu shot, right? We're gonna need to deal with the variants. It's part of the landscape. So there is going to be a long-term market for COVID and COVID-type vaccines. But yes, that you're partly right. I would just say, you know, part of it is that Moderna is an up-and-comer without that, you know, manufacturing global presence that a company like Pfizer already has.
To expand on that a little bit, what do you think the intellectual property landscape will look like in the coming years? As you alluded to, we potentially see a sort of RNA vaccine gold rush. Are there things that we should expect to see in the IP landscape?
Yeah, so this all new technologies sort of follow a fairly similar arc in that there's a lot of benefit if you're relying on intellectual property as your base or patents as your base. And I'm not addressing this question from what's good for the public perspective. This is from a business perspective. There's a lot of benefits to being the first entrant into a market. Because what that first entrance status gives you is the broad patents. So you get the platform technology patents. And so we're seeing the same thing playing out in the CRISPR space, right? So there you have two kind of academic institutions that are fighting it out for those very foundational patents and the control over them. And the control is about the licensing revenue. And that's the Broad Institute and the University of Berkeley that are fighting it out over CRISPR. So with the mRNA technologies, it's the same thing. You have these foundational broad patents that capture the field. That then means that follow-on patents are by definition narrower, right? Because they've got to be new, useful, and non-obvious. And so those narrower patents are going to be about specific products, or they're going to be improvements on those original patents. And when you've got an improvement patent, it means that you actually have to license the original patent. So you still have to, you know, license in the original technology, and then your new patents are improvements on that.
I haven't looked at this at all. I'm wondering if you have, but you know, we've been talking about Pfizer and Moderna. They both have messenger RNA-based COVID-19 vaccines that are very similar. In fact, they're often commonly referred to as interchangeable. But what are the specific, like, what are the patents that Pfizer has on these vaccines that Moderna doesn't have, and vice versa? I mean, can they both have these sort of foundational RNA-based vaccine patents, or do they have like slightly different ones? How does that work?
Yeah, so they are somewhat different. So the main thing about the mRNA patents, so there's the mRNA, you know, itself. And then there's the kind of the methods and the mechanisms around optimizing that mRNA. And then there is the delivery system, right? So how do you package that mRNA and turn it into a vaccine or a therapeutic agent? Mm-hmm. And so that's where they differ. And that's actually where Moderna might trip itself up a little bit. And so the Moderna vaccine is using a lipid nanoparticle delivery system.
So it's a tiny little bubble of fat.
A tiny little bubble of fat, exactly. And that tiny little bubble of fat does two things. First of all, the thing that it does is it protects the mRNA from getting itself attacked by the immune system. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that it does is it helps the mRNA get into the cell so that it can harness the cell machinery to make the spike protein. Mm-hmm. So the problem for Moderna is that they're being a little bit cagey about their little bubble of fat.
I see.
Because they're at one point in time, they licensed their little delivery system there from actually a Canadian company here in Vancouver called Arbutus. It's multi-generations of licensing and deals. So we'll just call it Arbutus for now, just because there's a nice tree-lined street near University of British Columbia called Arbutus, and the name is easier to remember. Hmm. So they took this molecule, and they've actually been fighting the Arbutus's patents, the validity of the patents, at the Intellectual Property Office in the United States. So you know that there's a problem there. If they're trying to invalidate the patents, it's because they haven't properly licensed them for use. Hmm. And so at some point, this is probably going to leave them some exposure that maybe they're infringing some patents on the delivery system. It's a little opaque. There's a big question mark there because they're being very secret. They're being very secret about their little bubble of fat. The regulators know all of the ins and outs of this because you don't want to leave people with the impression that they're so secret that the regulators don't know. It's just that the regulator, anything submitted for regulatory filing is under a cone of silence.
I wanted to ask you something. Let's say they did make this information public. Let's say the CEO of Pfizer was visited by three spirits over the course of the evening and woke up tomorrow morning and decided to share the information with the world. Could a Canadian company manufacture an mRNA vaccine? Like, do we have that type of scientific know-how in this country? Like, is it impossible for us to make a vaccine, or is it just that we don't have right now the legal approval to do that, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, so we have the ability in Canada to manufacture things for research purposes on the small scale. We do not have the capacity to scale up to massive manufacture at this time. But it's certainly something that the federal government is looking at investing in, and one of the lessons that we will take away from this pandemic.
So one of the dispiriting stories to come out of the race to develop COVID-19 vaccines, in my opinion, was what happened with Oxford University. Because they had pledged at the beginning of the pandemic to donate the rights of the coronavirus vaccine that they were working on, which already looked quite promising, to donate their rights to any drug maker in order to make their vaccine available either for free or at a low cost. Then a few weeks later, we saw the influence of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on the university, and the university changed its mind. They signed an exclusive vaccine deal with AstraZeneca, giving them sole rights, no guarantee at least of lower prices. And as Kaiser Health News reported at the time, the university now had the potential to make millions from this deal and get some prestige. Eventually, AstraZeneca partnered with Serum Institute of India for them to make the vaccine as well. But I am curious to hear your thoughts on what happened with this partnership as it was originally described between the university and with AstraZeneca, and also more broadly about the impact of ultra-wealthy philanthropists like Bill Gates on the course of public health, especially during the pandemic.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack in that question. So first of all, the Gates Foundation and Bill Gates in particular, Bill Gates built his wealth on a very strong intellectual property portfolio. And so he is a fan of intellectual property rights, particularly patent rights, and not a fan of weakening those rights, which any action on either waiving or compulsory licensing is a threat to patent rights. What you saw happen between Oxford and AstraZeneca, I'm not surprised. It goes back to my point about the offices of technology transfer at universities being a lot about generating licensing revenue and keeping the lights on. Now, part of that you can say is a good thing, because if a university is charging licensing revenue and getting a fair return on investment on a technology that it has developed, then it can reinvest that money in further research and development. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, is it really serving the public sector? So there is a philosophy, and this takes us to the philosophy of how you use your patent rights. How, when you have patent rights, what you do with them matters. And you can think about things from a global health perspective. And so you can patent defensively. So you can patent an invention to make sure that you cover the space so that you can actually use it for the public good, because you can always license things for the benefit of global health or the public. In general, especially in these kinds of platform technologies, exclusive licensing is frowned upon, because you can pick a dud as opposed to pick a winner to license to. And I think that has played out in the Oxford-AstraZeneca partnership, because obviously it all looked like a very good deal. AstraZeneca is a big global pharmaceutical industry. I'm sure Oxford did very well out of the deal. I'm sure that there are some things that we don't know about what they put into the licensing, whether they put some global access provisions into those licenses. But it turns out that AstraZeneca kind of dropped the ball. They did a pretty bad job at running a clinical trial. They had a disastrous rollout. They did terrible communications and public relations. And if anything, the deal has kind of dragged Oxford's name through the mud along with AstraZeneca.
So let me ask you a question. If the AstraZeneca vaccine had not had the problems it had with the blood clots, with the communication strategies, which we've talked about many, many times on the show, but if that had not happened, would there framework or their deal or their business model have made sense? Because in one sense, I would make, to play devil's advocate here, the AstraZeneca vaccine was going to be the cornerstone of the global vaccine effort. It was the major vaccine that was going to be part of COVAX. It was orders of magnitude cheaper than Pfizer and Moderna, and it was being licensed out to other companies to make. So isn't that in some sense the ideal? Like they didn't make it freely, Oxford didn't make it freely available to anybody, but in a practical sense, what they ultimately did do, would that not have been the next best thing in a practical sense?
Yeah, they could have also licensed it non-exclusively. So they could have licensed it to AstraZeneca and to other companies, mm-hmm. right? So you make more licensing revenue off an exclusive deal. Usually, you charge more for an exclusive license. If everything had played out properly, it probably wasn't a bad deal. But at the same time, if Oxford had made all of that know-how, freely available for anyone to pick up and use, You wouldn't have to go through all of these time-consuming transaction costs at now as between other manufacturers and AstraZeneca. So knowledge likes to flow, and what licensing and patenting does is it packages up that knowledge and slows down the flow, and makes it kind of sticky, right? Mm-hmm. And just think about it, that every single place where you need to negotiate, every single spot in that flow of knowledge where you stick a legal contract and a bunch of lawyers, that's sticky. that is gumming up the works in terms of getting the knowledge into the hands of people that can use it.
Do you think we will ever get back to a point where Jonas Salk, who invented the polio vaccine, for our listeners, Jonas Salk was once asked by a reporter in an interview who owned the patent to his new polio vaccine. And he thought about it for a second and he said, well, I guess the people do. I mean, you can't patent the sun. And, you know, the NFIP didn't patent the polio vaccine, right? Because it was funded through the March of Dimes, which was a charity. So it was really was the people who funded it. That was, I guess, the epitome of selflessness. Do you ever see a situation in which we can get back to something like that? Or is the era of, you know, here's the vaccine, go make it, private industry, are those days over?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're trying to get back to them. So, you know, there is an open science, movement that is basically, these are not normal markets. If you think about who the customer base is for vaccines in a public health crisis, the markets are governments and the markets are the people. And so, you know, anything that gums up the works in terms of getting things to the sectors or the manufacturing plants that are fundamentally running because of the people's money, is slowing things down. And so this is the difference between developing those open flow of knowledge, public-private partnerships during the discovery and research stage. So this is the before, while the horse is still in the barn, you fix the problem, as opposed to trying to do all of these kind of complicated backflips around different forms of licensing deals after the horse is bolted, when the patents are already granted.
So let me ask you a question about this. So in a better world where capitalism is still a thing, and we're not back into the Jonas Salk era, but COVID-19 happens, what would that system that you're describing, this open science collaboration between private and public, what does that look like? If we take the example of a vaccine, right? If we want to develop, produce, distribute vaccines faster in the middle of this pandemic, and to more people more equitably without compromising safety, can you take us through the journey of what that would look like for a vaccine?
Yeah, so as we know, a lot of the original R&D is done in the academic sector, in research laboratories. Admittedly, the scale up, the manufacturing know-how, and all of those things are generally better done by industry that work in these spaces. And so what you do is you develop a public-private partnership that takes you from the R&D stage through to that manufacturing stage with the guaranteed fair and reasonable price for the end product at the end of the day. And this means that you can put those, I'm going to say it in the context of a public health emergency and a vaccine, you can put those price controls into place from the start. And not have to spend a whole lot of time negotiating around, intellectual property rights. Now, that doesn't stop other companies coming in and taking portions of the technology to build out from in other sectors of the economy. There they can take things out and have narrower, more applicable intellectual property rights and patents in sectors that make sense. But in the what you're doing is you're keeping the big swimming pool where water can flow.
What is the incentive then for a private company to partner up with the public sector in that way? Because if you're saying that you agree to like lower prices from the beginning, like if I'm just a for-profit entity, what is my incentive for joining in a partnership like that?
Well, I would say, given the billions of dollars that have poured into from the public sector into the vaccine production system for getting 7 billion vaccines out to the world, I don't think that is a small amount of money to sneeze at, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I some people have argued with me that they're wondering why the private sector is even involved in the development and the manufacturing of pharmaceutical drugs and vaccines, and why we couldn't simply have university labs and governmental organizations taking on the R&D, the production, the distribution. Because I guess our argument is, well, pharma is driven by profits, which is bad, whereas the public sector is, in theory, not. Does this idea make sense to you? I mean, I know we've been talking a lot about these partnerships, but do you think it would even be a realistic goal to get the private sector out of drug and vaccine development?
No, I think that the system, we have a capitalist economy and a capitalist system. I think that there are places where an entrepreneurial state does a better job of getting vaccines and drugs to some patient groups and some populations. And so I think that there is a role for the private sector. Many of my colleagues will disagree with me on both sides of the fence. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is a role for the private sector in efficiently putting resources in and getting drugs through development pathways and into patients. But what we know is that they will chase the dollars in the larger markets. And so this puts us into the context of, in vaccine and drug development, there are areas of market failure. And the spaces of market failure that we generally think about are neglected diseases, mm-hmm. Rare diseases, and public health crises like the pandemic. And this is where there is, always has been, a traditionally larger role for state and state funding to step in. Mm-hmm. Now, we do this in a lot of industries. It's not just in vaccine and drug manufacture. If you think about, the nuclear sector or any other sector that touches on defense, if you look at missile defense, we have a lot of private contractors and the private sector, but their market is government. It's government that pays for those technologies. Mm-hmm, and those technologies are things that we hope never to use. They're an insurance policy. And yet there is no question that the government shouldn't be the major market that purchases, or both contributes to funding vast amounts of the research and development costs, and also is the major market. And so it's the same in a global or a public health crisis, right? We need to start developing and thinking about developing vaccines, therapeutics. That are setting us up to prepare for the inevitable next pandemic. And the way that we need to think about that is we need to think about who the market is. Well, the market is government, the market is states. So how can we most efficiently develop and design the ecosystem that is going to develop the next set of antivirals, antimicrobials, and vaccines for classes of infectious agents that we know have the potential to move into humans and become pandemic diseases? Mm-hmm. And from our perspective, that requires government investment to bring the brains, the know-how, the people, the R&D, and the manufacturing sectors together to be prepared for the next time round, to have the fire extinguisher on hand, right? And in our view, cluttering up these spaces with a lot of technology that requires the heavy hand of licensing negotiations and transaction costs will just slow things down. And keeping things in a open space where the science is done more transparently, and anybody that has the ability to take it up and move forward with a great idea to get us to that fire extinguisher stage for the next pandemic can do so. It's only with liberating and having multiple brains all working together to prepare us that we're going to avoid the kind of crisis that we face with this pandemic.
So we've been exchanging some amount of criticism of the pharmaceutical industry at its extremes, and this kind of criticism of pharma, it can easily slide into a complete lack of trust in their offerings, even to grand conspiracy theories about big pharma, which I'm sure you've heard. I'm reminded of the story in the late 90s and early aughts when Nelson Mandela wanted to pass the Medicines Act that would enable wider access to generic drugs, to important patented drugs in South Africa, and to its millions of people who were HIV positive. And he got sued by 40 multinational pharmaceutical companies who were claiming patent violation. There was a big PR fallout for these companies, and following a campaign by the Treatment Action Campaign Group, companies ended up reducing the prices of certain HIV drugs to make them more accessible. But in light of these, you know, sometimes disgusting chapters in the history of pharmaceutical companies where profits are put in front of people's lives, what do you tell people who tell you, you know, I just can't trust these companies anymore?
Well, I think that like any other sector, the pharmaceutical industry needs to earn our trust. And how do they earn our trust? Well, they earn our trust by developing efficacious and safe medicines that make a meaningful difference in the lives of patients, that are truly innovative, that aren't narrow me too modifications of drugs that came before to extend patent life and make a profit. So I think it's in the hands of the pharmaceutical industry to, in fact, deliver the kinds of therapies that patients are demanding and are needing. A lot of the innovation is going on both in the academic sector and in the smaller biotechnology companies. And, you know, promising technologies and a lot of the innovation is bought up by the pharmaceutical companies through mergers and acquisitions or through exclusive licensing deals. And so I think they have to prove their worth and get some of the value or their reputation back.
if I may throw something into the conversation, for anybody who's interested, read up on the history of the pharmaceutical industry, which to a large degree didn't exist prior to World War II. A lot of these companies were making soaps and perfumes and other products. They were chemical companies, not pharmaceutical companies. And their big, the big value that they added was they were able to mass produce stuff like penicillin and then later a polio vaccine. And they were able to mass produce these products in a way that, frankly, I don't think a government or university lab could have ever hoped to do. And so they're very, and you can tell me if you agree with this, I think they're very effective at producing a product. They're very effective at bringing a product to market. But a lot of their innovation actually is based on university research, publicly funded research. And I think pharmaceutical companies work best when they produce a product rather than trying to influence policy. And I think they've strayed from what their original foundational benefit to society was, which is, here's a polio vaccine, go make me 100 million doses so that kids don't have polio anymore. And we've sort of gotten away from that, admittedly, perhaps somewhat romanticized version of the past.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I do think that there are some fairly innovative, pharmaceutical companies that, especially in the working now in the biologic space. I think, to be fair to the biopharmaceutical industry, a lot of the low hanging fruit is on the market. Especially for different cancers, as we unpack the nature of the disease and we understand its complexity, we are needing to bring different forms of therapies to market. And those things take time and have a much greater incidence of failure in clinical trials. And we haven't tapped into and unpacked the really big ones like Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases. We keep having a failure after failure as we try to bring things through, and that is simply because the science is hard. So we do need to reinvigorate our pipelines and our ways of thinking by working out how to bring the best of all of the different sectors and the best brains together to collaborate to find solutions. And then at the same time, consumers of pharmaceutical products, we need to push back against gouging prices, especially when the things that are being delivered are only marginally or not at all more efficacious than cheaper or generic products that are already on the market. So, I think it behoves us as a society to question the value of new therapies and question the price according to that value. And that brings you back to what the pharmaceutical sector does very well, which is market its products.
Oh, yeah.
Marketing value needs to be based on some objective measures, not simply on a very slick marketing campaign that convinces us of value.
So Dean Tanya Bubala, thank you so much for talking to us today. This is the part of the show where I usually ask people to plug whatever it is that they have. I don't know if you're on social media, if you have a blog, if you have a podcast. Is there anything of yours that is sort of public facing that you would like to mention?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm pretty easy to find because my name is very unusual. I'm really hoping that we can push the hands of government to build open science public-private partnerships for the development of therapeutics and vaccines for what we know is coming, which is more pandemics.
Yes, and they will not be planned. We just know that they're going to happen. It's basic science. Dr. Tanya Bubala, thank you so much for your time and your expertise.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the body of evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at
the body of evidence.